Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, September 12, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will discuss the antitrust implications of pharmaceutical pricing, from Martin Shkreli to EpiPen. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Professor Michael A. Carrier, Distinguished Professor of Law at Rutgers Law School. I will turn it over to Professor Carrier to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us. The floor is yours.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Laura, and thank you all for joining the call. I'm excited to talk about pharmaceutical pricing and how there sometimes is a greater antitrust hook than is initially envisioned. Initially, the thought is that antitrust can't do anything about drug pricing under U.S. antitrust law, but sometimes there's more that lurks behind the scenes, and so that's what I'll talk about in the two cases of Martin Shkreli with Daraprim as well as Mylan's EpiPen. Just a bit of background, I have been teaching at Rutgers Law School for the past 17 years, and I've focused on the intersection of the antitrust and the intellectual property laws. There's a bit of a tension between the laws, as IP gives you a right to exclude, and sometimes antitrust can punish that exclusion. And so there are so many issues today when you think of antitrust and IP that it really is enough to keep attorneys and others busy. You think about the smartphone patent wars, you think about standard essential patents and what reasonable licensing is all about, and in particular, you look at the pharmaceutical industry. Pharmaceutical industry is really interesting because patents play a crucial role in pharma. There are studies that show that patents might not be needed in all industries for innovation, but in pharmaceuticals, they really are because it's so expensive to create a product and it takes so long to bring a product to market. But at the same time, you also have a really complicated regulatory regime. You have the federal Hatch-Waxman Act. That was Congress's resolution of innovation and competition in 1984. You have state laws that allow for drug substitution. You have markets that are very complicated because the buyer is not the same as the decision maker, unlike any other market. And also you have the event of generic entry. When a generic enters the market, the price can fall overnight, and so brand companies have an incentive to delay that moment of generic entry as long as possible. And so when you put all that together, you have a very complicated industry in which antitrust and other regulations try to make sense of what is going on. So before I get to the price increase, let me also mention something that doesn't get a lot of attention, which is the price staying high. When the price increases, politicians get upset, a lot of people talk about it, but what gets less attention is prices that stay high because that is not an event that is as newsworthy. So for example, sometimes brand name drug companies pay generic firms to stay off the market. They do this in settling patent litigation. We don't know who would have won the patent litigation, but there's a concern when the brand company excludes the generic not based on the strength of its patent, but rather based on this sum of money or other consideration that's going to the generic. And the point here is that when the brand pays the generic to delay entry, to drop its patent challenge, then the price stays higher longer than it otherwise would. So I'm going to spend the rest of the call talking about price increases, but it's also worth thinking about prices that stay high longer than they should. So now let me shift to price increases. The interesting thing here is that prices always go up. Drug companies frequently raise prices. They justify it based on recovering their development costs. And almost always, these do not get attention. They're not particularly controversial, at least for the smaller ones. And this is something that really flies under the radar. On the other hand, there are a couple of increases, and those are the two that I'll talk about today. Valeant has done some as well, where the price increase, for some reason, skyrockets into public consciousness. So with Daraprene, the price went up 5,000% overnight, even though the drug had been around for decades. With the EpiPen, this was right before people were going back, kids were going back to school last August, took off on a Facebook post that went viral. And so the interesting thing here is that even though price increases all the time, there are only a couple that have really received sustained public attention. And it's interesting to watch what the pharmaceutical industry does when this happens. So pharma is the industry association, primarily brand firms, and they said when Martin Shkreli raised prices 5,000%, that's not us, he's an outlier, and we price responsibly. And so that's another interesting point, that the pharmaceutical industry views these as not being typical. We also have Congress weighing in and politicians of both parties that say that these price increases are not justifiable. Nonetheless, we have some hearings and people get all upset, but there does not seem to be a lot that is done as a result. So let me now switch to the two actual cases. So the first involves a drug called Daraprene. Daraprene treats toxoplasmosis, which is a fatal parasitic brain infection in patients with weakened immune systems, like those suffering from HIV. The FDA approved this ingredient in 1953. Glaxo sold it for a dollar a pill for a long period of time. 2009, Glaxo sold the drug to a small firm called Core Pharma, who then increased the price to $13.50. From 2009, for the next 5 or 6 years, the drug was available widely through pharmacies and hospitals, but Martin Shkreli then was interested in purchasing the drug. So Martin Shkreli, for those who don't know, is someone who perhaps is not the most respected member of society, someone from my perspective who makes my work seem interesting. So you might imagine that as you go to cocktail parties and say that you do antitrust and IP law, you're met by, I don't know, maybe some attempts to go to the bathroom or get another drink or something like that. Once, however, you can say that you're taking on PharmaBro, that all of a sudden gets a lot more interest, because Martin Shkreli is the type of guy who showed up in Congress and took the Fifth Amendment to every question, including the most basic one. He's currently been charged with securities fraud. He bought the only copy of a Wu-Tang Clan song for $2 million just so no one else could have it. And to be timely for today's talk, just today, it was reported that he offered money to anyone that would get a lock of Hillary Clinton's hair. I don't know why he was interested. Anyway, he wanted that. And so the point is, this is not someone who gets a lot of sympathy from the public. And his company, Turing, in purchasing the drug from Core Pharma, apparently made it a condition of the sale that instead of being distributed broadly all over the country, it was only going to be distributed through one outlet, Walgreens Specialty Pharmacy. And that is the core of what I'll be talking about with Daraprene. Why was there a change from widespread distribution, which drug companies usually want to do, to a sole outlet? And I'll examine this as a case of potential monopolization. So monopolization is the antitrust doctrine that targets the activity of a single company. It has two parts. One is monopoly power. The other is exclusionary conduct. So first, let's think about monopoly power. Does Turing have the ability to increase prices or reduce output as a result of its purchase of the rights to Daraprene? Generally, there are two ways of showing monopoly power: indirect and direct proof. Indirect proof is the historical way, the traditional way in which monopoly power is shown. For that, you define the boundaries of the relevant market, what are substitutes from the consumer's perspective, and then you look at the market share. So if it has 90% of the market, that's clearly monopoly power. 75% might be enough as well. And then you look at barriers to entry. Are there barriers to entry? Here, it would seem like there is monopoly power because Turing has 100% of the market for drugs relating to Daraprim. There are no FDA-approved substitutes, and there are barriers to entry in the form of FDA approval, which is difficult for others to replicate. Notice that at the time, there was discussion that there was a compounded version. So maybe Daraprim did not have monopoly power. I'm not sure if that really is a substitute. Those are not approved by the FDA. They're typically not as safe as FDA-approved drugs. And so I would say that is not an alternative, although that's an issue of fact, and a court could always find otherwise. So that's indirect proof. And then the other way of showing monopoly power is direct proof. And there, you don't have to define the market because price has gone up or output has gone down. And for that, here you have a 5,000% price increase. That price increase was sustained. It was not rolled back, even despite the glare of politicians all across the country. You have consumers that were paying a lot more money, and you have output going down. Hospitals could not get the drug. And so this would be a way of showing monopoly power directly. In short, monopoly power would be more straightforward than the second prong of the analysis that I'll turn to in a second, but it would seem like there is monopoly power through indirect proof as well as direct proof. The next issue is exclusionary conduct. And so does Turing or did Turing engage in exclusionary conduct? It's tough to know exactly what that is because the monopolization case law is pretty sporadic. There's not a lot of it, and it usually starts out by asking whether or not the company engaged in willful acquisition or maintenance of monopoly power, that's bad, or growth or development as a consequence of a superior product, business acumen, or historic accident, and that's good. And so it's easy to state that, but it's tough to apply it. And so what antitrust law tends to do is it tends to find these cases. Every decade or so, you have a landmark case, and then we're stuck playing connect the dots, saying how the facts at issue are like case A or case B, and that's why there should or should not be liability. So three of the cases that have gotten a lot of attention and are relevant here, I'll mention very quickly. One is Aspen Skiing. There, the owner of three skiing facilities withdrew from a joint ticketing arrangement with another, a smaller competitor. And the Supreme Court found that the defendant forewent sales and sacrificed profits and thereby engaged in monopolization. In a second case called Otter Tail, the court found that the company had to share electric power transmission with rivals. It was already providing this to certain customers, and so it couldn't deny it to others. And in the third case called Trinco, Supreme Court said that the Telecommunications Act provided the regulatory regime that addressed competition. It broke up local monopolies, and therefore there is less of a need for antitrust. So how would these cases apply to what was going on in Daraprim? For starters, I would look at Trinco. And Trinco says, let's see what the regulatory regime is. Antitrust can't apply itself in a vacuum. We have to see what the regulations say. And here, when you look at the regulations, you look at the Hatch-Waxman Act, it has tons of provisions, or at least several really important provisions, about promoting generic entry. In particular, it says that a generic does not need to replicate. The brand's lengthy clinical trials, very expensive clinical trials, and by getting a sample, can submit what's known as an abbreviated new drug application, or an ANDA, instead of a new drug application, or NDA. And so that's something to keep in mind, a regulatory regime that says that samples are an essential part of how generics make it to market. In addition to that, you have conduct that is pretty concerning because it doesn't make any economic sense. As some Supreme Court decisions would say, it involves a sacrifice of profits. Initially, Daraprim was sold all over the country through numerous types of distribution mechanisms. What Turing did here was it voluntarily restricted that in a way that would make it less money. why would Turing restrict its distribution system to sacrifice profits? That doesn't make a lot of sense. And under the Supreme Court cases, I would say that that really raises some concern. In Aspen Skiing, the court talked about sacrifice. In Otter Tail, the court said you can't decide to refuse to sell to rivals just to maintain your monopoly position. There's always a concern with sharing your product with rivals, and the Trinco court was concerned, but a couple of those concerns don't seem to be relevant here. One involves forced sharing, but the company Turing was already selling. This is a part of the Hatch-Waxman regime. Pharma is unique. It's not like other industries. What about judicial involvement? Do courts have to get involved? Not necessarily. This is a one-time sale. It's not like a court sitting there as a price regulator. And so when you look at the profit sacrifice, the fact that this is a simple sale from a product that's already on the market, and the fact that it is already available distinguishes it from the Trinco case, where the court said Verizon has to go into the bowels of the company to bring out a service that was not available before. And finally, if there were any doubt as to why Turing was doing this, there is evidence that Turing did this to hurt generics. So John Haas, the director of patient access, said that he would, quote, block a purchase, close quote, if a generic sought it. And a couple others, they would do our best to avoid generic competition and not make it easier for generics. And so, at the end of the day, it seems like there is exclusionary conduct here. If you look at Trinco, it says let's focus on the regulatory regime. If you look at Aspen and Otter Tail, you see some profit sacrifice. And then you see that the director of access at the company says we only did this to hurt the generic. That's not something that has some pro-competitive justifications to outweigh the anti-competitive effects. This really does seem concerning, potentially a case of monopolization. The second case that I will talk about involves the EpiPen. So the EpiPen, of course, is a device that is essential in treating allergic reactions. When a patient has an anaphylactic reaction, they could go into shock and even die. Food allergies or other allergies are the reasons why a lot of people walk around with EpiPens. And Mylan got a lot of attention last summer because it increased the price 400% between 2009 and 2016. This was not as much of an increase as the Daraprim increase. That was 5,000% all at once. Rather, this was every 6 months, a 10 or 15% increase that added up to 400%. And so here, just like Daraprim, we have a product that's been around for a very long time. Adrenaline was marketed since the early 20th century. Epinephrine is basically the same as adrenaline. You had the manufacturer, Meridian, that introduced the EpiPen in the 1980s. Then you had Mylan in 2007 that was in charge of the distribution rights. At the same time, over the past several years, the government has taken some actions that have increased the availability of the EpiPen, saying that this could be used as a first-line treatment, making it okay to sell this in doses of two instead of one, increasing the availability of the EpiPen in schools. And so these are all ways in which the EpiPen became prevalent in society. Whether or not there have been competitors on the market is an interesting issue. It's changed over time. So Adrenaclick was one competitor, but it didn't seem to do well until recently when CVS paired up with it to offer it for $110 with a $100 rebate, so it could be $10. That has increased its penetration into the market. And then the AviQ was a recorded voice device, but that had to be pulled from the market and then came back earlier this year. So in short, there haven't been that many alternatives to the EpiPen, although that's starting to change recently, but that is another reason why the EpiPen has gotten so much attention and so many people rely on it. And so when you look at the EpiPen, my argument here is that just like with Daraprim, it's not just a price increase, but there's something else going on behind the scenes. In particular, I find three types of activity that allowed Mylan to keep the prices high and to increase the prices. The first was a settlement. And so there was patent infringement litigation. Mylan's partner, Meridian and King, sued Teva for patent infringement in 2009. 2012, there was a bench trial, and the parties settled. Mylan technically was not a party to that litigation, but it seemed to be intimately involved. When the settlement was announced, it was Mylan that issued the press release. It was the CEO of Mylan that talked about it, and so Mylan seemed to be involved. That settlement provided for 3 years of delayed generic entry. In other words, Teva would not enter the market from April 2012 until May of 2015. During that period of time, prices doubled and Teva was not trying to get FDA review. One question is whether or not there is a settlement with payment. So we know that there was a settlement, but we don't know if there is a payment because this is not something that we have access to. The FTC sees it. We don't. There's private litigation where a union is trying to get information on the settlement, but that's really important. I would argue that it seems at least conceivable, perhaps even likely, that there was payment. And the reason is that Teva was doing well in the patent litigation. The judge had issued a claim construction interpreting the terms of the patent that favored Teva. In addition, this is a lucrative market. Teva shows no hesitation at entering these really big markets. They enter at risk, in other words, before a court decision that the patent is invalid, more than any other company. And this was a huge market. They were scheduled to make $50 million or forecast to make $50 million in the first year. Why would they just sit on their hands when they had a good case for such a lucrative market? In any event, that is the first type of conduct, a settlement by which Teva delayed entering the market between 2012 and 2015. The second type of conduct involves a citizen petition. A citizen petition is meant to raise safety concerns with the FDA. In practice, it really has been used to delay generic entry. I did an empirical study last year where I looked at all citizen petitions over a five-year period, finding that the FDA denied 92% of them, 98% of them at the last minute, when the brand company filed the petition within 6 months of the expiration of a patent or data exclusivity period. And so these citizen petitions sometimes do not seem to be the most persuasive or most justified. Rather, they seem to be a way to delay generic entry. And the same goes for what happened here. So here, the citizen petition was filed in January of 2015. The FDA was expected to rule by June of 2015. One question is why this was filed in 2015. It would seem like Mylan knew from the patent infringement litigation that it was intimately involved in, that it knew about Teva's generic as early as 2008, and it knew about particular documents in 2010. Question then is, why is Mylan waiting from 2010 to 2015 to file a citizen petition? That doesn't make a lot of sense. Perhaps they waited to get some extra days or weeks or months of monopoly after the terms of the settlement ran out. In addition, a supplemental study was filed in May 2015. An expert said that this was a frivolous study. There was no control group. The participants, it was a small number. They weren't given proper instructions. And again, that would seem to have been filed to delay generic entry even more. And so when you look at the timing of all this, the supplemental study, it seems like this raises concern. Generally, when you file a petition with the government, you have immunity. It's known as Knorr-Pennington immunity, but there's an exception and covers sham behavior. And I'd say that this is potentially sham behavior. If Mylan knew about this in 2008 and 2010, didn't file it until 2015, keyed to the timing of the settlement with a questionable supplemental study, that raises a lot of questions. Finally, exclusive dealing is something that Mylan could have used to block present competitors. So the settlements and citizen petitions could be used to block future competitors like Teva. Exclusive dealing could block present competitors like Adrenaclick and AviQ. So here we have the 2013 passage of the School Access to Emergency Epinephrine Act that gave preferential funding to states that keep an emergency supply for students. And just about all states require or encourage the EpiPen to be kept, or at least a device like the EpiPen, to be kept at schools. And that would seem to be a good thing for students at school. If the student does not bring an EpiPen with them, it's a good thing that the nurse has it. It's also a good thing that Mylan gave a lot of these EpiPens for free to schools. But let me focus on one piece where it gave discounted EpiPens to other schools. Because even though it's good that Mylan provided a discounted EpiPen, given how expensive the EpiPens are, it only did that on condition that the schools agreed for a 12-month period not to buy any other competitor devices. And so this is something that Mylan conceded that they did. It was in order forms for the past 3 years. And so the question is, what do we think about that exclusive dealing? Schools, you can get our discounted EpiPen only on agreement that you not deal with rivals. For that, antitrust looks at foreclosure. How much of the market is foreclosed by this arrangement? Historically, 30 to 40% of the market was enough. We don't know the exact amount of discounted EpiPens that were offered, but I would say that foreclosure is less important than it was. Now, for starters, we're viewing schools as their own market. If schools compete with other places like homes or amusement parks, then that would be something else. But it seems like schools really are a market where there's no substitution during the day. Kids have to go to school, so we view that as a market. I'd say that even if you don't have the 30 or 40% foreclosure, you have other factors that courts have looked at that shows that exclusive dealing is a concern. So you have high barriers to entry. The FDA has to approve these devices. The agency is really cautious in approving devices in this context because the consequence of getting it wrong is pretty extreme. It's that the patient would die. So this is not some medication that works a little bit in a trivial fashion. This is a serious medication, and that's why the FDA is cautious. This is a barrier to entry. In addition, you have a price increase of 400%, which would show a direct effect. You have Mylan with a significant share of the market. Initially, it was somewhere in the 90s. Now it's fallen. I think it's somewhere in the 70s. And so that's a high effect as well. So even though there might not be enough foreclosure by itself to show exclusive dealing, there are multiple other factors that raise concern here. So in short, when you hear about the EpiPen price increase and hear that antitrust has no role to play, think of the behavior that does not get as much attention. The settlement that kept Teva off the market, the citizen petition that was filed late to get a little more delay, and the exclusive dealing with schools that encouraged schools to buy the EpiPen in contrast to rivals. And when you hear about Daraprim and the 5,000% increase and hear that antitrust doesn't have a role to play there, ask yourself why the company would voluntarily restrict its distribution scheme so that it would make fewer profits. The reason really did seem to be to hurt generics. And so that is my sense on why sometimes increased drug prices do lead to a role for antitrust, because there is anti-competitive behavior that is hidden behind the scenes. Thank you so much for your attention, and I look forward to your questions.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing a question from the audience, I'll ask one of my own. How often does this contact take place outside of the two cases that you described?
So it's tough to know for sure. So I, as someone who focuses on antitrust law, view these price increases as an opportunity to see if there are antitrust violations that are lurking that other folks have not noticed. And so these two types of behavior have gotten a lot of attention, and that's why I looked at them in detail. It's not possible to know how often this sort of behavior takes place, but there are some characteristics that sometimes lie behind price increases. So the Senate Aging Committee submitted a report last December where they looked at price increases where the drug was off patent. And usually when a drug is on patent, you say, well, the brand company has control over the market, and so if they want to increase price, they can. It's more concerning when you have something that's off patent, and that was concerning in the Daraprim and EpiPen cases. It's not like these price increases are needed for R&D recoupment. This is something that was developed decades ago, and the patent has long run out on it. And so I don't know the exact examples, but if you look at the Senate Aging Report, they talk about things like a sole source drug where there's just one manufacturer. It's a small market, closed distribution. So maybe you look at those characteristics and say that those make it amenable to price increases even if you don't have the anti-competitive behavior. And then finally, just a point that I started with, sometimes it's not the price increase, but the sustained high prices that lead to a role for antitrust, but those, just by their definition, do not tend to get as much attention.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our first audience question. Go ahead, caller.
Sorry, I was on mute. Wasn't the FDA a big barrier to the entry of copycat EpiPens?
Sure. So there's plenty of blame to go around. And so what I do is I focus on the anti-competitive angle. But yes, the FDA did not approve these competitor EpiPens perhaps as fast as they should have. And so there are multiple reasons for the problems here. When Heather Bresch, the CEO of Mylan, showed up, she blamed everyone else in the system. So she said, you know what, Mylan's actually not making a lot of money. It is everyone else in the system, the middlemen, the PBMs, the wholesalers, they're all making money. Certainly the FDA can deserve some blame for this as well. And so when we talk about the pharmaceutical industry, I focused on the antitrust angle, but you're right, there are other government agencies and such a complicated pharmaceutical distribution chain that there's plenty of blame to go around.
In an ideal world, we would simply make the FDA voluntary, like the good housekeeping seal of approval, and then they wouldn't be able to stop people from making good products.
Yeah, and so it's an interesting question. Well, what should the FDA do? If you made it voluntary, then perhaps there would be other market mechanisms to discipline perhaps manufacturers that do not offer safe medications. On the other hand, if it's a device that is really dangerous, maybe we might want government approval. So one way of looking at this is thinking about compounded drugs. And so with compounding, you have a system of drugs where it does not receive FDA approval. And right after the Daraprim case hit, it was announced shortly thereafter that a competitor was creating a compounded version for only a dollar. And so a lot of people said, well, the antitrust problem's over because you now have an alternative for a dollar. And so this could be a way of testing your theory. if that truly was an alternative, then that's the case study because you don't need to have FDA approval. And so it would seem like sometimes there are issues. So compounding is something that is considered on a state-by-state basis. Sometimes there are issues, and so there have been infectious outbreaks, there's been meningitis. Sometimes there have been issues here, but on the other hand, for someone who wants to pay a dollar rather than $750, maybe it makes more sense. And so I'd say that's one setting in which you could test the theory about how much you need the FDA.
Our lines are wide open. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, September 14th at 3 p.m. That call will be a civil rights call on law firm preferences. A reminder, keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on our website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. Let's go to our next question.
Hello, it's Gorky. I have two questions, please. First, were any pro-competitive justifications adduced for the price increases? And second, what remedies would you propose in each case?
So in terms of the pro-competitive justifications, in the Daraprim case, Shkreli said that he would use the money received from the price increases and then use it for R&D. That is a justification that is frequently offered. And in fact, it's one of the most basic justifications just because it is so expensive to create these patented drugs. Some folks said, you know what, this might not be the most persuasive justification in this case because this is a drug that the FDA approved in 1953. It's not like there's any new R&D going on with this. The context also was concerning. It's not like Turing played any role in developing the drug. They purchased it from a company that had it before. And so that was the proposed justification, although I think it's subject to question. In terms of the EpiPen, what the CEO said at the hearing was that Mylan really is not gaining much of this profit at all, that it's really everyone else in the distribution chain, and so Mylan's really not getting that much. I can't recall if she said that they had to increase price in order to cover these higher costs or not, but that might be another possibility as well. The reason why I like antitrust in this context is that the remedy is more targeted. And so in the U.S., we don't have price regulation. There are other countries around the world, Europe being the biggest entity, where there is more of a focus on price, where if the price is too high, that can be viewed as an antitrust violation. In the U.S., we don't have that. And so when I focus on the antitrust hook behind the scenes, I think that that's something that antitrust is more susceptible of doing. So what then would we do in these cases with Daraprim that could, it would focus on the distribution restriction? And if an agency like the Federal Trade Commission brought that case, and if it found that there was an antitrust violation, then there could be a couple things that would be done. One would be an injunction that would force it to open up its system. Another would be damages for excessive prices that were paid. So usually when we talk about an injunction, that leads to concerns about the government structuring the regime, and certainly those are valid concerns. But here you have a predecessor. You have the fact that it was widespread distribution before, and so we already know how it works because they did that in the past. And damages are easier to measure. You just look at how much higher the price was as a result of this anti-competitive behavior. In terms of the EpiPen, the same thing. I guess it's a little harder with a settlement that has already passed. And so if if Teva's kept off the market from 2012 to 2015, the question is, well, what harm was suffered? And that's a really complicated question, because you could say Teva was kept off the market for that period of time and Teva otherwise could have been on the market. But Teva did not have FDA approval, and Teva still does not have FDA approval. So you could say, well, there's no harm because Teva still doesn't have FDA approval, so no harm, no foul. I think, however, that the truth is a little more nuanced than that. I think that if Teva entered into a settlement, perhaps even receiving payment, to delay entering the market, then it's not going to use its strongest efforts to try to enter the market. And so it's possible that it did not try its hardest, and there is evidence in some of these drug patent settlement cases that after the generic settles with the brand, it slow walks the FDA approval process. So now you see why these are really complicated issues, because we don't know exactly what the but-for world would have looked like. When would Teva have received approval but for the settlement? And so that's a tough issue, but we'd have to figure that out to see when Teva would have entered the market. Same thing on a smaller level with a citizen petition. Usually you have settlements that keep generics off the market for years, and then citizen petitions that keep them off the market for months. So it's a smaller scale problem, but still one that antitrust could look at. And then in terms of exclusive dealing, that's something that I think could have the biggest effect, because this is ongoing. There still are these contracts in place with the schools, as far as I'm aware. And so if this is found to be anti-competitive, that is a type of change, and it's a change that's easily done. You just say that these contracts are not going to be enforced anymore. That could make a difference. And I'm not sure how much of a market there is here. So I know that there are free EpiPens that I think take up about half the schools. Discounted EpiPens are a much smaller percentage. I'm not sure what. So in short, you have to look at each of these types of conduct and see what can be done going forward and what damages are appropriate looking backwards in terms of higher prices than should have been paid.
Let's go to our next caller.
FDA at some point took control of medical devices, which they didn't have before. I think it was back in the 80s. And I don't know if the EpiPen was started to be used before that, but a lot of older devices were grandfathered in. So that's one question. Did the FDA even have to approve the EpiPen? When did the EpiPen first get used? I have a second question, but let's answer that one first.
So the EpiPen was introduced in the 1980s by Meridian, and I'm not sure the exact timing of that. Let's see. So it, I wrote an article on this, so luckily for what I forget, I can remind myself what I knew at one point. And so the EpiPen was introduced to the market in 1980, and received FDA approval in 1987.
Okay, yeah. The next question is, can an FDA chair or perhaps his employees, who is a former drug company executive or perhaps a future drug company executive, be complicit in an antitrust violation?
So it would be really hard to bring an antitrust claim against an FDA chair. And so one question is, when you try to sue the government itself, an issue that has gotten a lot of attention in the last few days, which is sovereign immunity. And so it takes me off on a 15-second tangent of games that sometimes have been played to delay generic entry. There is actually a really big case involving Allergan transferring its patents to an Indian tribe to avoid review at the patent office. And so that has gotten a lot of attention. It seems to be concerning. But the question there is, can the tribe be sued, or the patents it has, can you challenge those at the patent office? Maybe no, if there is a version of sovereign immunity that applies to the tribes. And so here, sovereign immunity to the FDA, my guess is that you can't sue the FDA or the chair of the FDA. There could be a waiver. I'm venturing a little outside my expertise, but maybe if there was something beyond the ordinary course in which the chair did something that doesn't fall under sovereign immunity. There could be waiver. Just as I articulate it, my sense is that probably not. At a minimum, it would be extremely difficult to bring a case against the FDA chair, though I defer to those who know more about sovereign immunity than I.
Again, our lines are wide open. So to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound key. While we wait for our next audience questions, I'll ask one of my own. Could you speak to the state of the law on reverse payment settlements?
Sure. So one of the ways in which Teva was delayed from entering the market involved a settlement in which the brand company settled patent infringement litigation by having Teva enter the market 3 years later. So with settlements, the question is, what is leading to the exclusion of the generic from the market? Where the exclusion just comes from the strength of the patent, that's completely fine. Where it comes from payment, that's not. And so that is a distinction that the Supreme Court recognized 4 years ago in a case called FTC v. Activists. The lower courts had diverged on the standard that should be applied. Most of the courts said the scope of the patent test was fine, that if as long as you had a patent, then any payment was fine because it's a subset of the right to exclude. Supreme Court, however, found that you're preventing these challenges from these patents from being challenged, and antitrust has a role to play as well. And so that's where we learned that payment to delay entry is a concern. For the past 4 years, courts have tried to figure out what the Supreme Court meant in Activists. The issue that has gotten the most attention involves payment. Is payment limited to cash alone, or does it include other types of consideration? I think this is an easy issue. It's Econ 101 that the form of the consideration doesn't make a difference. If a brand pays a generic $100 million to delay and that's a problem, then the brand making a promise that's worth $100 million is just as bad. Most of the courts came out the right way. A couple of district courts did not. Those were reversed on appeal. Supreme Court declined to get involved. So I think that issue is now behind us. The issues that now are pending in the courts involve the structure of the antitrust analysis. Who has to prove what when? The causation issue that I mentioned in a different context is relevant as well. The pleading standards, there was a decision from the Third Circuit a few weeks ago that said that the plaintiff only has to satisfy standards under cases known as Twombly or Iqbal that say that the plaintiff has to have significant allegations, but it doesn't have to actually prove evidence in a complaint. And so those are some of the issues that the courts are dealing with. I'd say the big easy issues of cash versus non-cash are behind us, and now courts are going to wade their way through a bunch of smaller, more complicated issues.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for another audience question, I'll ask one of my own. Could you talk a little bit about citizen petitions and what's going on with that?
Sure. So citizen petitions are petitions filed with the FDA, and they are designed to raise safety concerns. And so it certainly makes a lot of sense in theory if someone has knowledge that there is a drug that's unsafe, that you should be able to raise that with the FDA. My sense, however, is that these are really done to delay generic entry. So about 7 years ago, I conducted the first empirical study of citizen petitions, looking at all petitions filed between 2001 and 2010, finding that the FDA denied 81% of those petitions. I just did another study last year looking at petitions between 2011 and 2015 that target what are known as 505Q petitions. And there you have a petition that's filed against a pending generic. So my thought was that's where we would be more likely to see anti-competitive harm. And I found that, as I mentioned before, The FDA denied almost all of these. 92% were denied. Most of these were filed by brand firms. Also, 92% were filed by brand firms. And when the petition was filed at the last minute, within 6 months of the end of a patent term or the end of an FDA exclusivity period, the FDA can give exclusivity for things like new active ingredients or new clinical trials. Within 6 months of either of those periods, the FDA denied 49 out of 50 petitions, or 98%, leading me to conclude that there really are a lot of concerns with citizen petitions. And I'm not the only one. And so there have been cases filed by private parties, but notably earlier this year, the FTC filed its first complaint against a citizen petition or behavior related to citizen petitions, saying that this was an abuse of the regulatory process. And even though the FTC is understaffed, this was a bipartisan complaint. Maureen Olhausen, the chair of the FTC, was fully behind it. In a case in which Charvara Pharma engaged in 43 FDA filings, three FDA lawsuits, it seemed a little frivolous. These seem to be filed at the last minute. There are committees that unanimously rejected these claims. Nonetheless, they kept filing them. There was evidence that this was a long shot or Hail Mary, according to the FTC. And so this is behavior that the FTC is now going after. And I think that there actually can be bipartisan support of an abuse of the citizen petition process, because this is an abuse of the regulatory scheme that I think can get support from both sides of the aisle. And so that is the latest on citizen petitions.
I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any, would you like to make some final remarks?
Well, I just wanted to thank everyone for coming. Drug price increases will continue to be in the news. I don't think that politicians are actually going to do anything about it. I think that there will be a lot of grandstanding over this issue, but at the end of the day, there still will be price increases. But if I ask you to take one thought away from this call, it's that when there is a significant price increase, don't ask just what antitrust can do about it, but think about, and I recognize it's tough to do for members of the lay public, but think about whether or not there's anti-competitive behavior behind these price increases, things like a settlement, a petition, a restricted distribution system that might explain the reason why the price went up in the first place. And so thank you again for your attention. I'm very grateful. Thanks again.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.